Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on the program, we host a debate on recently proposed legislation, which, if passed, would mandate nationwide labeling of genetically engineered foods. We're joined by Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, and Thomas Reddick, Legal Counsel of the U.S. Soybean Export Council and the United Soybean Board. But first, we have a very special conversation with Malik Yakini, Executive Director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and founder of D-Town Farm, an urban farm. It's about his work in fighting with social justice, food equity, against racism, for food security in the city of Detroit. Lessons we can learn here in Baltimore. Let's start from the very beginning. Let's start from the middle. Describe for our listeners first what D-Town is and what this food security network is in Detroit.
Okay, the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network is a nonprofit 501c3 organization which has a membership base of about 70 people that has four core programs, with D-Town Farm being our largest and most labor-intensive program. We have a youth program called the Food Warriors Youth Development Program that services about 200 children in two schools and one church in Detroit, and teaches them about sustainable agriculture and teaches them to look at the food system in their own community with more critical eyes. We have a lecture series called the What's for Dinner Lecture Series that's co-sponsored by the Detroit Public Library, which runs every other month from April through October. And then we have a food co-op, a buying club at this point, a cooperative buying club that functions once a month, where members of the co-op can get food at below retail prices. And we're working very hard to morph that into a brick-and-mortar retail co-op store.
Now, and D-Town Farm, this is on 7 acres in the middle of Detroit?
It's not in the middle of Detroit. It's in Detroit, but it's 7 acres. It's actually kind of almost at the western edge of Detroit in the city's largest park, which is called Rouge Park. So the area of the park we're in was formerly a tree nursery, and as the city's budget fell into decline, they weren't really able to maintain the tree nursery. And so they have offered part of it to us, and the other part is run by another nonprofit called the Greening of Detroit, which has kind of returned it to its original purpose of planting trees that they then transplant in front of businesses and homes throughout Detroit. We're more a model of what can be done. Mm-hmm. And we don't make any claims to be feeding large numbers of people, because we're not. But what we are doing is we're planting the seeds in terms of the great potential of urban agriculture and modeling various techniques that can be used throughout the city, such as vertical gardening, such as row cropping, such as raised beds, composting, and what have you, so that other people can emulate what we're doing either on larger scales or on the same scale we're doing if they can obtain the land. So we're more a model farm. We are a production farm also. I mean, we do produce tons and tons and tons of produce. I don't have the exact figures in front of me right now. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we do produce large amounts of produce on that 7 acres. But clearly not enough to make a significant dent in the serious lack of access to fresh food in the city of Detroit.
So, and what happens to the food that you do produce? Where does it go?
We sell primarily at farmers markets in Detroit. We sell to some restaurants, and we sell to a couple of restaurants. I'm sorry, we sell to some restaurants, and we sell to a couple of retail stores. Actually, we have a farm operations meeting every other Sunday. This past Sunday, just yesterday, I was in a meeting where we were looking at all of the retail establishments that want to purchase our food. And the reality is that the demand for the food that we grow is greater than our capacity to provide that food. And so what we're doing is looking at the retail outlets and seeing which are most aligned with our own values. For example, Whole Foods is very interested in buying food from us, and that could be a steady customer and a good source of income, but it's not as aligned with our values as some of the other markets that are serving some of the more underserved communities in Detroit.
Can you talk a little more deeply about what do you mean not aligned with your values?
Well, the Whole Foods is opening in Detroit. And let me preface this by saying I'm not anti-Whole Foods.
Right.
But there's a large-scale gentrification happening in various neighborhoods in Detroit. And so Whole Foods is dropping down into one of those neighborhoods that is a highly gentrified neighborhood. And so we have lots and lots of young whites who have moved into the city in that particular neighborhood. And so Whole Foods being there almost solidifies the gentrification of that area. So it's not so much that I'm anti-Whole Foods, but I'm anti kind of the context that they're moving into. And so typically Whole Foods serves more affluent customers, you know, although they say that they have many products that are comparable to what people would find in typical grocery stores. But we don't really see Whole Foods as serving the majority population in the city of Detroit or significantly impacting the lack of food access for the majority of Detroiters.
That's interesting. So, I mean, what you're describing in some ways, the movement you have, the Black Community Food Security Network and the D-Town Farm, I mean, it's as much as a political movement, it seems, in some ways, as it is a food movement. And you really kind of develop how those two ideas are interconnected.
Yeah, for sure. In fact, I was a political activist for many years before I knew anything about a food movement. I was personally interested in food because within the Black movement, and I'm using that term in a very broad sense because it's certainly not monolithic and there's been various manifestations and various ideologies within that broad movement, but there have been strains within the movement that have stressed the importance of food and diet on a personal level to have the energy and the strength to be able to participate in a robust manner in transforming society. And so I had a personal interest in that for many, many years, but wasn't really aware of the food movement per se. And so I think one of the strengths that we bring to the table is that we've been able to kind of merge these radical politics that we have with this the kind of green movement, the food movement, and merge those two things in a very seamless way. So for us, really the work of transforming the food system is kind of a lens that we use in terms of how the whole society needs to be transformed. For example, we talk a lot about racism in the food system. Well, racism exists in the society in general. It doesn't exist in a special way in the food system. So more what we're doing is using food system work to help people see the need for transformation of the larger society.
Let me ask this question about the question of poor communities, especially communities of color, but not solely communities of color, where food scarcity is a very serious issue. Yes. Food insecurity is a very serious issue. Yes. And you've said that, you know, D-Town Farm clearly is trying to lead the way on some levels politically, but you're not a movement that's there to kind of feed Detroit directly. So what are the ideas about how we address that in urban areas? I mean, with all these vacant lots that every major post-industrial city has. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we think that urban agriculture plays a role in providing greater access to food. And, I mean, we're producing tons and tons and tons of food, but still in a city of 713,000, we're only dropping the bucket. But Detroit has something like 103,000 vacant lots. And so we think the city has the potential to produce about 10% of the produce that we consume right in the city of Detroit. And other cities probably have, maybe to a lesser degree, but have similar capacity. And so we think that's part of the solution. It's not the entire solution. We need to, of course, cause the major food producers and food distributors to behave in a more responsible, accountable way, because still for the foreseeable future, we're getting the majority of our food from this industrial food system. And so we need to address the structural inequities that exist within that system and with how food is brought to communities and really address the whole idea of the commodification of food, because we come down to a point now where grocery stores look at, when they look at where they should locate, they're looking almost primarily at what their bottom line will be in terms of sales. And so we have to look at food access in terms of something beyond just the bottom line. And that's a real challenge because we live in a capitalist society where everything is driven by profit. But our position is that food is a basic human right and that people have the right to good, clean food regardless of their economic station in life. So we do think, again, that urban agriculture has great potential for filling part of that gap, but it's certainly not the only solution. We also need to develop relationships with rural farmers. And so we're not under any illusion that urban agriculture is going to replace the need for rural farmers. We think we can supplement what rural farmers are doing and that we need to develop relationships that haven't previously been developed between majority people of color, urban communities, and majority white rural farmers because we have kind of this common interest. They have a market that they can sell to, and then we have these large areas that have lack of access to fresh produce, and many times the two have just never talked. And so we think that part of developing this new food system is creating these conversations among people who previously haven't been at the table together.
That sounds also subversive, Malik. But I I mean that in a positive sense. But let me explore a couple of things you just said there. So there's a lot of conversation in America about urban agriculture. Yes. And you've just described how you don't think that urban ag can really feed urban populations on its own. So what is the purpose of, what's the reason, what's the need for urban agriculture to exist then? Is it to address a symbolic thing, issue, or is it something more substantial and fundamental?
Well, I mean, we do think that urban ag can play a substantial role in feeding urban populations. We don't think it's going to be the only thing that will provide food. But again, you know, a benchmark in the next few years in Detroit is to get up to the 10% mark. We think we're providing about 1% of the food right now. And I mean, there are examples in Havana, Cuba, they're providing something like 80% of the produce that's consumed in the city. So there is potential for ramping that up beyond 10%. But even if we're providing 10% of the produce, it does significantly impact the lack of food access. And also, equally as importantly, it injects millions of dollars into the local economy and stimulates the economy and creates jobs and creates empowerment and creates ownership. So that's also important. But it's symbolically important as well, because I think what has happened in American society is that people have ceded responsibility for their own lives either to the government or to academic institutions or to corporations. And so just the act of beginning to take back the food system and growing part of our food is really a political act and an act of asserting our full humanity. So symbolically, it's important in that regard as well.
I'm really interested in exploring in some depth what you just said about this bridge that you think has to be built between what are mostly rural white farmers and people of color who live in communities, especially given the price structure of agriculture, especially given how much food costs in reality to produce and what it costs at the table and how the profit system is built into that. It's a very complex thing. It's not easy to parse this thing out and create this. Could you talk a bit more about your thoughts on that?
I mean, this is a very complex situation, and it deals with federal policy. It deals with artificial pricing of things. It deals with exploitation of labor. And so, you know, clearly I don't have all the answers to those. Right. And, you know, lots of people have their heads wrapped around it. We're trying to figure this thing out.
Right.
But clearly there's a relationship between a farmer's ability to earn a living and live a comfortable life and having the markets to sell their goods to, besides selling to ADM and, you know, the kind of large aggregators.
Cargill and the rest.
Yes.
Right.
And so if we're able to create systems where farmers are selling directly to markets in urban areas, we create a consistent market for those farmers and enable them to live a livable life and enable them to begin to break away from this kind of industrial farming paradigm that many of them are locked into. And so that's part of it. But, you know, also, you know, as I'm sure you're aware and your listeners are probably aware, much of the food in America is artificially low in price. And so we have a real challenge because we have to figure out how to provide food to people in urban populations that have little disposable income and also provide a fair living for the farmers. And so that means that really you know, prices of some foods need to go up so that farmers and farm workers can be paid a livable wage, and people have to adjust to, you know, to paying the real cost of food. So that's a real dilemma.
Given that what I've read that you've done and the work you're doing in Detroit and some of the things you've written, that you're one of the people, I think, in America that I've heard about who's kind of trying to grapple with these issues and also throw in the complexity of race in America into the equation. And that's why I was asking the question, not to kind of stump the guest, but to really kind of figure out how we begin to get to this. Because, I mean, talk a bit about the question of how race feeds into this, because that, to me, seems to be multi-layered as well, whether you're talking about a food movement in America that is perceived as a mostly white people, whether it's the organic farmers or people who want to eat better, what that is, and how that ties into the history of race and how that fits in for you.
Well, being from Detroit, which is a predominantly African-American city, and having grown up in Detroit in the 1960s, during, before, and after the rebellion, much of my worldview is shaped by the social construct that we call race. And I always preface my comments on this by saying that race is a social construct. It's not a scientific and a biological reality. But nonetheless, if we were to ignore it and act as if it didn't exist, we'd be we'd be in trouble. So race permeates every institution within American society, and certainly the food system is no exception. It's not the only criteria that's used to decide who has access to good food and who doesn't, but it is one. And as you mentioned earlier, income or class is another factor. So these factors of race, class, and gender all intersect to determine kind of who has access to good food and who doesn't. So there's many rural communities also that don't have good food access. In fact, in many places, the people who are growing the food can't afford good food either. So this is a problem that's pervasive in American society, and it's symptomatic of this kind of broken food system that we have. But race certainly is a factor, and it's a factor in determining to some extent where grocery stores are located. It's a factor, and where grocery stores locate, again, is related to income and related to class. And so we've had this intentional disinvestment in communities such as Detroit beginning in the late 1950s, accelerating in the 1960s with the white flight after the urban rebellion in Detroit, and continuing through the 1990s. We're starting to see a reverse in that trend now with whites coming back into the city, into some of the neighborhoods that I mentioned earlier that are being gentrified. So with the intentional disinvestment in areas which was largely influenced by race, we have these urban core areas that have been left to really languish and deteriorate. And part of that deterioration has been the abandoning of those areas by retail food operators. And so that's one way in which race plays into this equation. The other way is that within the food system, race helps to determine who gets what jobs. And so there's a report released a couple of years ago by the Applied Research Center called The Color of Food that really quantifies how there's serious racial discrimination within the food system, and that people of color tend to be on the bottom rungs of the food system, and the top rungs of the food system tend to be whites. And so we see, you know, we see race playing out in terms of who has jobs and makes decisions within the food system. But also, as you mentioned, within the food movement, we have racism continuing to manifest itself. The reality is, and I don't want to get into blame and shame, because I don't really play that game.
Right, right.
But because in a sense, we're all victims. We're all victimized by the system of white supremacy. And so even whites who have good intentions, unless they really dedicate themselves to studying how race plays out in this society and how they've internalized these concepts, they end up unintentionally acting out concepts that continue to create the imbalance of power that we see in American society. And so because young whites or older whites even decide that they want to have better access to food for people, or decide that they want to see a food system which is not so heavily dependent on petroleum products and not so heavily dependent on subsidies from the government, and is more aligned with the principles of organic agriculture and other forms of sustainable agriculture. Because they have a dedication to that does not mean they've divested themselves of the remnants of white supremacist thinking and of white privilege. So often what happens is we have well-meaning whites who come into communities of color who assume that they know what's best for that community. And again, their intentions are golden. They're not coming in with the intention of exploiting the community. They're coming in from their perspective of helping that community. But what happens is often they are not aware of what the existing assets are within that community, what the existing leadership structure is in that community, or even what the aspirations of the people in that particular neighborhood are. And so they come in almost like missionaries, assuming that they know what's best for the community. And then that coupled with the fact that funders often fund those organizations that have the track record of handling large sums of money and have the capacity and the staffing to implement various projects. And so they often come into communities with large amounts of funding, which makes them almost like the overlords. And then that coupled with the fact that many times they all hire their friends. They'll hire the people they know the best and that they're most comfortable with. And so we see in many communities of color, nonprofits that are staffed primarily by young whites, that are led primarily by young whites, but doing work with African-American or Latino, Latina children. And so that presents a serious problem. It continues, again, the same inequity, and it also undermines the ability of those communities of color to exhibit self-determination. So those are some of the ways in which race manifests within the food system.
Do you think that the at the core of this idea of building an urban agricultural movement, building urban agriculture in America, that, let's say for argument's sake, you just said, could feed perhaps 10% of a city's community, is that a world that can be developed where communities of color can actually, and other people can actually work and live, create a lifestyle, create a way of making a living that can also be kind of transformative for an entire community? I mean, do you see that as a possibility as part of a movement building in America?
I don't see urban agriculture as being a panacea. Some people paint this as, you know, this is the answer to our problem. I don't see that. I think this is one factor in a very complex puzzle of various pieces that fit together to create a vibrant community. One of the things about an oppressive society is it tends to suggest to people that they don't have the capacity to shape their own reality. And I mentioned this earlier, that we've ceded responsibility for our lives in many ways to the corporate, academic, and governmental structures within the society. And so part of our work is really kind of to take back this capacity to shape our own lives, that we can determine on an individual basis, a family basis, and within our communities what happens. And so, you know, just that kind of light going off in people's heads, we think is profound. And then once they start to see, oh, well, I can grow, you know, a significant portion of the food I consume, then, you know, they say, well, maybe I can educate my child too. Maybe we can start schools, or maybe we can produce clothing. You know, imagine that, you know, that we could produce shirts or, you know, pairs of pants. You know, we don't have to be dependent upon on the kind of multinational corporations for our survival. So that a large part of our work is really just trying to get that light to go off. And once people begin thinking more critically, they come up with all kind of ways to meet their needs. And so, you know, we see ourselves as being a catalyst to encourage people to think more critically about our lives and about how we take control of our lives and how we take control of our communities. Wherever I go, I'm raising the issue of racism within the food system and within the food movement and trying to get people to think more critically about it. This discussion on race is a very uncomfortable discussion in American society. We often sweep it under the rug. And so based on my experience in Detroit growing up as a black activist, this has been part of my analysis for the last 40 years. And so I'm very comfortable talking about it. And I'm able to now fuse that with this discussion on the food movement and the food system. And so I always bring that. But I also bring an analysis of this system of unbridled capitalism that we have and how that plays into, in fact, is probably the major defining force in this kind of broken food system that we have. And so I'm not under any illusion that we're going to create a new food system without fundamentally changing the economic system in American society. And then also, as a reforming chauvinist, I always bring a message about gender equity and how we all need to be more aware not only of the role women play in society and ensuring that women have equity, but also of honoring the feminine energy, because none of us can be whole without honoring that, including men. And so, you know, in my 20s, I was trying to be very macho, and so that underdevelops men. So I'm interested in the total development of all members of society. And, you know, you asked me about my transformation. So diet is just one part of my transformation, but also there's been this political and cultural transformation that I've been going through, and I'm still in process. You know, but since I was about 13, and again, growing up in Detroit in kind of this post-rebellion period and having gone to a school that was a hotbed of black consciousness, I began thinking at a very early age about political systems, economic systems, about culture, and about the role that race plays in American society. And so thinking deeply about those things over a period of several decades has been very transformative for me, and also practicing various disciplines to rid myself of antiquated ways of thinking and trying to adopt ways of thinking that are more acceptable for someone who wants to see freedom and justice for humanity. So this has been a very long personal journey for me, and it's been done both individually in terms of my own individual study and practice, but also done in conjunction with groups of people who are trying to make the same transformation. And that's one of the messages that I bring, that as we're trying to transform, it's not just done individually. You don't just go to a cave and meditate and come to some revelation, but you do it through working in concert with others who are trying to make the same change.
Well, this has been an amazing discussion. Malik Yakini, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for everything you've given us today. And I look forward to talking again.
Thank you very much.
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll enter a debate on whether or not genetically engineered foods should be labeled. We are going to tackle once again the question of GMOs. There's an email we received from Food and Water Watch about the support they gave to the new bill in Congress that is called the Genetically Engineered Food Rights No Act. And there's also a bill in a number of states, but most recently, Washington State has introduced a bill, I-522, which is a citizen's ballot initiative requiring mandatory labeling of all genetically engineered foods. And as soon as that happened, the executives from Monsanto, DuPont, and Dow, who are the world's largest developers of biotech crops, said they were going to launch a campaign to turn tide against those things. And last year, of course, they... You know, she spent $40 million to defeat the labeling measure in California, which did go down in defeat. And we have joining us today to talk about all that, Thomas Reddick. Tom Reddick is the principal at the Global Environmental Ethics Council, a law firm practicing liability prevention. He represents the U.S. Soybean Export Council and the United Soybean Board, and co-editor of Thwarting Consumer Choice, the Case Against Mandatory Labeling for Genetically Modified Foods. And Patty Lavera joins us once again. Patty Lavera is Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team, and Tom Reddick. And Patty Lavera, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good morning.
So this is this battle is after California is not ending. It's heating up, if anything else, with all the states picking up referendums around the country. And Patty, since I mentioned you first, could you just begin by kind of talking about what the statement is you put out and why you came out in support of this bill in Congress?
Sure. So this is, Congress is getting into the act, basically. So we have a bill in the House and also one in the Senate that would require this labeling, and that's similar to what I think we're over 20 or 25 states had bills this session. It was on the ballot in California. It's going to be on the ballot in Washington. So I think it just shows how much interest there is in this, and we're now 15 or longer years, you know, into living with, with the biotechnology industry having a much bigger role in the food supply. And when consumers learn about the extent to which this stuff is in our food system, they want to know what foods it's in. It's very, very clear that they want to know this. And so we just think that having Congress weigh in as well is what we need to do to start moving towards having this labeling.
And Tom, your initial reaction when you heard about this bill that was put in?
Yes, I would say the bill in Congress probably won't pass through this Congress. It's going to take a lot of support that isn't Washington, I-522, probably has the support, most importantly, of Whole Foods Market, which did not give very good support to California Prop 37, partly because it had a zero tolerance and a lot of problems in that law. Washington, maybe a law with fewer of those obvious problems, and I do expect to see a close vote and possibly passage of that law. It's probably going to be preempted in federal court litigation shortly after it is passed. So there's another layer of problems with the state laws.
All right, let me come to that, because there's a debate over, and a significant debate over whether states can pass these laws. Some legal experts arguing you can, some arguing you can't. We're going to come to that in a minute. But tell me what it is that you, why you oppose this law, both Washington State and why, which you just said was kind of had less holes in it than California, which we can talk about, but also the new federal bills. What's your opposition?
Certainly. As counsel for soybean growers, I also represent the non-GMO soybean growers, some of whom are also organic producers. We have a voluntary system for labeling non-GMO foods. And it's got an industry standard that's international. Whole Foods Market recently adopted it and is implementing it. There's a tolerance there that's comparable to Europe. It's 0.9% for any GM content. Internationally, though, there's a 5% tolerance that operates in Asia, and that provides for any consumer that wants to buy non-GMO food around the world, you can do so. It's quite simple to do. You just buy the non-GMO label. And having that label, why would we need to bother with the federal government or any other government adding another layer, particularly 50 states with 50 different tolerances or requirements? That would make a very difficult thing for an existing market that serves consumer needs.
And, Patty, what's your take on the whole voluntary issue? That's clearly a big part of this argument on the industry side.
It's a big part of the argument whenever we talk about food labels. Doesn't matter what the label is, country of origin labeling, labeling GMOs. I mean, we hear this all the time. And if voluntary labeling was working so well, you would not see the level of interest you're seeing across the country at the grassroots, people devoting, huge amounts of their lives to trying to change this law because they're very motivated because they want this information and they're not seeing it in the marketplace. And then, you know, we talk a lot to organic farmers and non-GMO farmers, and they're really, really fed up that they have to set up infrastructure and do testing and set up a whole system to label something they're not using when the folks using this controversial technology get away with not having to tell anybody that they're using it. So the burden of voluntary programs worries us, and we also just don't see enough coverage. Too many folks don't know what they're eating because we don't have that much voluntary labeling out there.
So when you look at things like, when you look at places like Trader Joe's, which is in many ways more affordable than some of the other places like that for many people, not everybody, but for many people, I mean, they've decided they're going to label their in-house brands they're labeling as GMO, as non-GMO, but not requiring anybody else to do it. And Whole Foods, which is a very, very expensive place to shop, they say by 2018 they want them labeled. So what's the difference between that and having legislation that says that all food must be labeled as GE or GMO or non-GE, non-GMO? I mean, so what's essentially the difference here between those two systems? Tom, and then I'll go back to Patty.
Well, certainly. I guess Patty would probably say that doesn't cover every store, and it's true. I mean, Walmart is going to be selling sweet corn in cans, and they, to my knowledge, haven't adopted a similar voluntary labeling, although there are a lot of internal industry discussions about possibly doing that. Part of the problem we have when we do a voluntary labeling is we need to figure out what the consumers really want labeled, because there are certain products that Europe labels, soybean oils, for example, that have no trace of any protein or anything that could be harmful. Yet they're labeled in Europe, partly because, similar to the way we would label dolphin-safe tuna, we want information on a label about a process. There's no relation to the safety. There's legal problems. We just lost that in the World Trade Organization. Dolphin-safe labeling is not legal under the World Trade Organization. And our country of origin labeling law also got attacked and could lose internationally. So the federal law, if we do pass it, we might see someone claiming our GM labeling law violates World Trade Organization. I wouldn't be surprised if Canada filed such a case. And I do think the voluntary, we have to work with it. But Whole Foods Market's going to find out whether consumers care about labeling oil or they're just worried about food allergies and just want things that have actual traceable protein in them, like the corn chips that they sell might have some percentage of GM content, and some mothers want to avoid that. And I credit a good mother who's got a potentially allergenic child with wanting to protect her child. That's why we do label for problems that could threaten health.
Patty, what's your thought on that?
So the voluntary system is at this point putting the burden on folks not using this technology. So there's a certified GM-free label, organic, you can't do this, but organic tells you other stuff. And what we're talking about with these laws, you know, whether it's the state laws that are being considered or the one that Congress just introduced, is forcing the users of the technology, so folks that are using GMO seeds, would have to carry that labeling through to the food. And so that is a more appropriate approach, we think, when we're talking about something that folks have concerns with. And so we've had this conversation about a lot of things, cloning and cloned animals, which is also biotechnology, GMOs. So part of it is a burden issue. Who should have to, you know, do the work of labeling? We think it should be the users of this technology that people are asking about. And then part of it is, you know, voluntary doesn't give much accountability to consumers. It's very hard to know, you know, where you're going to get it, where you're not going to get it. And not everybody in the country has a Whole Foods. Not everybody in places where they have Whole Foods can afford to shop there, right? So we think everybody deserves this, not just certain. We don't want this disclosure of information to become a premium that some people get and some people don't get. We think it's basic information about how the food was raised, what kind of system it was raised in, and we think there's health issues that have to be addressed as well. And so for that reason, we think everybody deserves the label.
So one of the things that you raise an issue here that I think that people kind of really wonder a lot about, because it was brought up in the California referendum battle, which has to do with the cost. One of the things that the argument on the industry side that swayed a number of people and even seemed to sway the California NAACP was that it would make the cost of food rise. But the people who support GMO labeling point to all the other labeling that takes place already on foods that has not caused a rise in the cost of food, whether it is, as we just said, country of origin and salt content and et cetera, all the things that are already labeled, Tom. So, I mean, how real for you is this whole notion that's going to cost money? Is this, just to be blunt about it, is this as kind of a twist on facts to make the argument stronger, to not label?
There's certainly added cost. I thought the study in California saying $400 per person was low, and I consult with a number of very good agriculture economists, including some who are not particularly fond of GMOs, who also said, well, there's a lot of elements of cost they didn't include. A part of what we see in Europe is billions of dollars of cost when they implemented GM labeling, as food companies were afraid of putting what they thought might be deemed the skull and crossbones type label, and sourced higher priced inputs, which led to a lot of trade disruption. So if the United States, in any particular state like California or Washington, has a big market, you know, everybody's going to have to label if they want to sell food, and people label for the country. They don't label for California, and they would try to avoid the input, which causes them to go after non-GMO markets. So for my non-GMO soybean growers, if there's a fair and reasonable standard on this, they would make a lot of additional premiums. And it's important to note, Patty, that these folks actually get paid for this process. So I've seen up to 100%, like double price for soybeans when the market's hot. And if there is a cost of keeping it separate, that's part of why they get paid extra. You know, these higher prices are paid to compensate them for the fact they do have to have a dedicated stream of commerce. It's the same thing with blue corn for the cool corn chips that are blue. That has to be kept separate so it doesn't have a lot of yellow corn in it. And they get extra for that.
But the question, Patty, is what I mean, I'm curious about when people argue that that labeling foods as GM or GE or free of either, what's your sense of what that costs or doesn't cost? I mean, when I look at all the other labels on our food.
Right. So we read the California study as well and had the opposite reaction. We thought it was overstated.
I'm not surprised.
What it was going to cost consumers. So, and, you know, we have systems, and it will take segregating these products so you know what you're labeling, et cetera. You know, but we're doing that for most of the rest of the world, which requires this labeling. So a lot of our farmers and processors and brokers are already doing this for our export markets. They know how to do it. You know, what we're talking about, when I'm talking about the burden on non-users of technology, folks that are, you know, that are labeling as GMO-free or organic, what I hear mostly about is the difficulty in keeping that product separate in a system that's so dominated by biotech. And that's probably a talk for another show about contamination and those kinds of issues. And it's just kind of the principle of the thing that they had to set up this system. They had to, you know, define the system, which they've done and they're doing, and they're hopefully getting that money back in the market, although to hear some of them talk, they don't get it all back. You know, so hopefully they're figuring out how to make that work for them in premium markets. But there's a principle of the thing that really offends a lot of them, that they had to do this when they're not the ones using GMOs. And then to get back to the cost to consumers, you know, when we're talking about labeling the majority of the product in a lot of food supplies, if we're talking about corn and soy, you know, we think that that will be spread out further and it really won't be a big cost to consumers. And we think that's a cost that the processors will figure out, and they'll figure out if it's worth using the ingredient and spending the money to put the label on there, or using a different ingredient and not having to put the label on there, and they will figure that out, and that will sort itself out. Lots of the rest of the world has figured out how to do this. Lots of the rest of the world has this labeling. We are lagging behind and not having it, so we don't think it's that difficult, and we just hear this every time we have conversations about food labels, including nutrition labels and, you know, allergen labels and things that folks are very used to seeing now. We heard that the sky was going to fall when we had laws say that you had to put them on there.
Right, because this is not the battle to kind of say that we want to – that some people want to see – to ban GE and GMO foods. I mean, there's groups – there are people who do want that, Tom. This is labeling. This is something different. Though so I've heard people argue in this program – from BIO and other places, that it's just it's the camel's nose under the tent. That's one of the reasons we're opposing it, not because it's going to hurt the industry, but it's because it's just a way to get after us, and we're trying to stop you here.
Well, there's certainly the case that in California and other places where they've advocated the GM labeling, at the core of it, and it's in their literature, we would like to ban this so that our growers don't have to keep avoiding it. So there is this, I think it's very difficult to say how you're going to ban 90% of the soybeans that are now planted, 90% of the corn. But that is an element. They think the government skull and crossbones will help drive people off the market. It certainly worked in Europe, and billions of dollars were lost by U.S. growers by GM labeling in Europe. So we don't need to see another repeat of that in our own home turf. It's very sensible to stick to the same system we've had for 15 years of non-GMO labeling.
But before we go back to Patty, for the industry itself, let's say, wouldn't it make more sense then to label it? Because that would open the markets even more in Europe than they have now. Right?
Well, I don't think that would open any markets to label it, because they're not buying any GMOs. They've by labeling it, led consumers to think there's something to be afraid of, and there are no GM-labeled products in any significant markets in Europe. There's occasional reports I get, and I do follow every single thing, a few in Denmark that tried it, but there's no GM food market in Europe. It's because they don't have choice. We have choice here. You could buy off-brand corn chips. If you really want to eat a GMO, you might be able to find some tortillas or corn chips that aren't in the non-GMO system. But most of the people that are concerned about GMOs don't shop in the discount line at the store. So that's where you... It's very paternalistic to say we need to impose a costly system to protect people from danger that doesn't exist that they should be concerned about.
Patty?
Where to begin? We would definitely argue about the dismissing of any concerns. I mean, the system for evaluating these things, for these crops, and saying whether they're safe to eat is totally inadequate, as many parts of our food safety regulation are. And then I think more and more folks are tuning in to what this change, the adoption of GMOs, has meant for agriculture, and more folks are looking at, you know, including things like the environmental burden of using the herbicides that the crops are engineered to resist, that they're working in a package deal, and we're seeing, you know, a change in in what's happening to the environment and how folks are farming, and that's part of people's shopping decisions too, and that's appropriate, and that's growing, and I don't think it's paternalistic to give people information so they can decide for themselves. If biotech goes out there and convinces everybody with the bus ads they run down here in D.C. on the metro and on the bus, and they tell us all how great it is, if that works and people have this label, then they can choose to buy it. I don't think it's paternalistic to give people more information, and they can decide for themselves.
But the reality, I've represented major food companies, and none of them want to put a GM label on their brand. So
they do not.
Happen in Europe. Yeah, they don't want to have anybody. Part of it is that their brand is sacred to them. They don't want anybody tinkering with their label for that sort of process-based thing. At the FDA hearing, the FDA actually expanded on it. Some of the folks at the FDA panel, and these are regulators, were saying, look, if we put this process on, what else are we going to have to put on? Are we going to have to come up with the next thing might be, is it natural, and we have to have a federal natural label, or we have to have a federal label that's, I mean, for example, is it non-kosher? I mean, that's, we've got a voluntary kosher market. We don't go out and add the non-kosher process for people who want to avoid it. I don't think we could just do GM. We'd have to say we've got a new system. We're not just labeling for safety. We're labeling for anything that causes some sector of the population some concern that's other than something based on safety.
So what is it, just a political question for the two of you. What's the essential difference between what we're seeing take place now on Capitol Hill and maybe Washington State? I'm not familiar with the other states that have legislation at the moment. I will be next time. But I know Washington State, and I know Capitol Hill. What's the essential difference between what happened there in terms of the bill itself, and what the bill said, and what happened in California?
Well, if I could just jump in, she mentioned the natural cases, which actually are the core litigation preemption cases, because those are actually suing for the presence of GMOs that is in the natural product, and the courts are saying our federal system of labeling is so comprehensive, so detailed, that it preempts any state attempt to reinterpret what it means. So I do think we're at a situation where Washington, if it passes its law, is going to run into California type, and that's a California case. So it's in federal court. And there are other cases. Vermont learned in the BST labeling for milk that it can't, the First Amendment does not allow you to compel speech as a state. So there's several different legal arguments that would derail Washington, and I do think that speaks toward letting the federal government, if it can get enough votes, write a labeling law. But as I pointed out, that probably could violate the WTO as our cool country of origin labeling did and our dolphin safe labeling. It's not going to be an easy thing to do as a federal government either.
Patty?
Well, I mean, I think no matter what happens, the first time a state passes a law on this, someone is going to sue them. That's the way it works. The companies that are involved in this have tremendous legal firepower, which they feel free to use regularly. So whether or not it's justified, I think it probably will go to court. And that's the way things work now. That doesn't mean it's not worth doing. And it doesn't mean that it, I mean, there's a, you know, there's often many, many, many issues where the states go first. And I think this is just one of them. The federal government is slower, especially now, and harder to move. But, I mean, we're interested in working on all those levels. People are working at their state level, and that's going to build momentum to eventually change the law at the federal level, which does need to change. You know, as for the World Trade Organization,
yeah.
You know, I don't think average Americans really care what the WTO has to say. When they go to the grocery store, they want to know what they're buying. We work a lot on country of origin labeling, and actually the WTO said, yeah, you're allowed to have this label. They said you're allowed to have this label. Lots of other countries have it. There was just a particular, fueled by the meat industry, fight about what labels here say. And so there's going to be work to fix those labels to make the WTO happy. I don't think that the WTO should be our overriding concern when we decide what our U.S. law is about what U.S. citizens get to know about their food. And this is a bigger conversation about trade and priorities, but lots of the rest of the world has GMO labeling. So for they can figure it out. There are trade legal standards for how to do it. And also, I think Americans don't really think that should be the way that we decide what we're eating.
So just to conclude the next couple of minutes here, and I, for you, the bottom line of all this, I mean, we talked about natural, the label natural, which is, I guess you would agree, Thomas, is really kind of a, it's a marketing ploy. Companies can put it on. It means different things for different companies. We don't really know what the world, what that means. But for this, people would know that it meant what it meant. And that's the question, is that that's the bottom line for some people. But I'm curious as to how you would round that out in terms of the bottom line for many industries and why they're opposed to this bill, why they're opposed to what some people think is consumer information.
Certainly. It's something, take for example Anheuser-Busch. I used to be the attorney for those folks. They're now a European company. But there's a company that doesn't want people to tell them what to put on their label and would not sit idly by while the federal government mandated a new, what they consider skull and crossbone warning type label for inputs that are genetically engineered to resist pests and have certain environmental benefits. I mean, it's not, there's no sense in it. So I think industry is reasonable to oppose labels that start down this path of having a tiny minority of people who want it. And honestly, when you ask the right kind of poll and say, is there anything you want on the label? About 1% say GMO. If you say, I want to ask you now, don't you want to label genetically modified food? Then you get to 90%. So we don't think there's really an actual market for people to put a GM label and sell into this marketplace. It's just going to confuse folks and cost a lot to try to get rid of it by buying non-GMO input.
Patty?
Well, I mean, this is a bigger conversation we've been having for years about food labels, when it's the company that gets to make marketing claims about how fantastic the product is and how it's going to change your life and how it's new and improved. They got all the creativity in the world. They can redesign labels. They can do all this stuff, and they can, you know, to try to sell us something. But the minute it's about giving people information that's somewhat standardized, right, and not left to the company to define, like natural, we hear about how it's the hardest thing ever, and they can't do it, and that people somehow don't deserve to know this. And it's just, you know, we're a consumer advocacy group, and it is astonishing how often the food and ag industry's response to consumers is to tell them that they're stupid and that they should shut up and eat and they shouldn't ask questions and that they don't deserve to know. So this is just the latest round in this. And so we think, if they're so proud of this technology and it's so fantastic, then they should put it on the label and they should, you know, make the pitch and convince people to want to buy it.
Well, I just want to say,
well, there's an irony here. I mean, I don't think anybody's stupid. I think there's the smartest people in the world and eating food these days. They can scan it with a smartphone and get information. So that little label is the least informative part of our whole universe of food information. And when you can live in a world like this where there's so much information, you don't really need to have the government putting tiny little GMs to give you any information. It's very devoid of any actual information about the process or the product.
Well, this has been fascinating. And I think that we're just beginning this argument here, discussion here on Soundbites. And you've laid out a lot of really interesting facts from both perspectives. You just heard Tom Reddick. Tom Reddick is principal of the Global Environmental Ethics Council, and Patty Lavera, assistant director of Food and Water Watch, where she coordinates the food team. Thank you both so much for joining us here on Soundbites on Delmarva.
Thank you. It's been very enjoyable.
And look forward to having you both back.
All right. Great.
Take care.
Thanks.
Thank you. And that's all we have time for this week. I'd like to thank all of our guests, Patty Lavera, Thomas Reddick, and Malik Yakini, and all of you for listening. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. It's made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.